Due to the graphic nature of this Kingpin's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. On June 9, 1993, 36-year-old Joaquin Guzman Loera sat down for an interview in a prison in Toluca, Mexico. The man known as El Chapo grinned across the table at the senior government official, expecting to charm him with his easy manner and disarming smile. El Chapo didn't understand why the official was upset. He'd done as he was asked. He'd given his statement on all the men he'd worked with in the drug industry, as well as the corrupt officials who protected them.
But the official wasn't there to cut a deal with El Chapo. He was there to send a message. Keep his mouth shut. He said he knew that El Chapo was married and had at least one ex-wife by now, plus at least 6 or 7 children. If he ever wanted to see them again, he needed to be careful.
As the official walked to the door, El Chapo considered killing the man right there, just for the threat. But something told him that murder wasn't going to solve this problem. If he wanted to survive in here, he was going to have to beat these men at their own game.
Welcome to Kingpins, a podcast original. I'm Alastair Murden.
And I'm Kate Leonard. Every Friday, we journey inside the ranks of organized crime rings, from street gangs to mafiosos, to understand how a kingpin or queenpin rises to the top of the underworld.
And why they fall. As we follow the lives of infamous crime bosses, we'll explore how money and power change them, and how it changed the community around them.
You can find episodes of Kingpins and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Kingpins for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Kingpins in the search bar.
This is our second of 3 episodes on Joaquin Guzman Loera, the infamous Mexican cartel boss known as El Chapo. Last week, we explored his rise from a simple marijuana grower to a leading figure in the Guadalajara cartel. This week, we'll find out how El Chapo became a Mexican folk hero as he built up the Sinaloa cartel.
We'll dive into El Chapo's growing drug empire right after this.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs. Drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
From the journal, Trillion Dollar Shot. Find it in the journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.
On June 9th, 1993, 36-year-old Joaquin Guzman was arrested for the first time. Despite working in the drug industry since his childhood, he miraculously had never run into trouble with the law before now.
El Chapo had climbed his way up through the Mexican drug world in the 1970s and 80s, at a time when one single cartel, run by Miguel Ángel Félix Gallardo, was wresting control of the country's entire industry. The young man quickly earned a reputation for intelligence, ambition, and brutality. Traits that served him well when Félix was arrested in 1989. The cartel's remaining leaders started jockeying for control of territory, and El Chapo found himself working under the boss in Ciudad Juárez, Amado Carrillo Fuentes.
But El Chapo wasn't content with this placement. Instead, he launched a violent war to gain control of the prime trafficking area around Tijuana. But in doing so, he signed his own arrest warrant.
Having never been arrested before, El Chapo followed in the footsteps of many lower-level traffickers. He offered to spill the beans on fellow narcos. He was even willing to snitch on corrupt government and police officials.
But those men had no intention of letting their underworld connections get out. An unnamed government official visited El Chapo to warn him that he wouldn't live to see the end of his 20-year sentence if he talked. Always a quick learner, El Chapo clammed up.
Throughout his trial, El Chapo played along, claiming that he was merely a poor farmer from Sinaloa who'd never met any of the renowned narcos he was supposed to be associated with. Everyone knew this was patently false.
But the story endeared him to the public, even as the media painted him as a cunning, murderous crime boss. People found him charming and a bit cheeky, an underdog facing down the corrupt establishment. So instead of shying away from publicity, El Chapo used his new public image to his advantage. By the time he was convicted in 1995, El Chapo had become one of the most visible and well-known faces of the Mexican drug world.
After his sentencing in November 1995, El Chapo was sent to the high-security prison of Puente Grande in the state of Jalisco. When he arrived, he was reunited with his old associate, Hector Palma Salazar, known as El Güero.
It's very likely that Palma was the one who told El Chapo that his arrest might not have been an accident, that their boss, Amado Carrillo Fuentes, had probably left him to the wolves because of all the trouble he had stirred up. El Chapo had never been known to let a betrayal slide, and he had killed men for far less.
At the same time, he knew he couldn't have the head of the cartel murdered without massive retaliation. But if he gained a little more power, he could get there. And so the 38-year-old narco set out to build his empire from within the walls of Puente Grande.
Like most Mexican prisons at the time, the purported security at Puente Grande was no match for bribery and connections. If he took advantage of the loose restrictions, he could still call the shots and run his trafficking routes through intermediaries.
He started by charming and bribing the prison staff, a feat all too easy. It didn't take much for El Chapo to get a hold of a cell phone and earn regular visits from his most trusted lieutenants.
With his brother running things on the outside, El Chapo continued to expand his operation, developing more exclusive relationships with the Colombians and moving billions of dollars of cocaine across the border. He passed along orders for new tunnels under the U.S.-Mexico border and refused to give up on his Tijuana expansion.
At the same time, his cousins, the five Beltran Leyva brothers, followed his orders to start building relationships with the Mexican government and business elite. He wanted to make sure the government wouldn't stand in his way again.
With every move El Chapo made over the next year and a half, his power and wealth grew. Even though he was in prison, he had become a bigger player than before.
But the game changed again on July 3, 1997. Amado Carrillo Fuentes, one of the last of the old guard of Mexican drug lords, died while undergoing plastic surgery to disguise his appearance.
According to the official story, Carrillo Fuentes woke up during the operation, demanding more pain medication. The doctors were too scared to refuse him, but the extra dosage led to heart failure and killed him.
This all sounds totally plausible for someone like Carrillo Fuentes, but within weeks, rumors circulated that the body on the autopsy table wasn't actually him, but a disfigured decoy. The theory was that he'd faked his death and disappeared before one of his ambitious young lieutenants offed him.
Either way, Carrillo Fuentes was out of the picture, and suddenly, El Chapo found himself in the running to claim his spot. Of course, he had competition, including some former rivals.
The Arellano Felix brothers, as well as the Gulf Cartel, immediately started to move into one of the most lucrative areas controlled by Carrillo Fuentes, the border town of Ciudad Juarez. The other narcos in the area wouldn't stand for that, but none of them trusted each other enough to let any one person take over Juarez alone. So, 49-year-old Ismael Zambada Garcia, known as El Mayo, suggested they form an alliance to shut out the Arellano Felix brothers, the heads of the Tijuana cartel.
Most of the others didn't want to include El Chapo, but Zambada insisted. He and El Chapo worked well together, with Zambada's business savvy complementing El Chapo's decisiveness and brutality. Zambada also knew El Chapo's ruthless ambition would be necessary if they were going to win this fight.
El Chapo didn't have much of a say into the arrangement, but he signed on and ordered his subordinates to help Zambada continue the war in Tijuana.
The leaders of the Tijuana cartel were formidable foes. With their alleged strong government ties, it seemed impossible to displace them from Tijuana. But at least Zambada's uneasy alliance worked well enough to keep both the Arellano Felix brothers and the Gulf Cartel from getting a foothold in Ciudad Juarez.
Meanwhile, it was decided that Rodolfo Carrillo Fuentes, Amado's brother, would take over control of the trafficking hub. The savvy Zambada also figured that having a weaker boss, and one who owed him a favor, would work to his advantage.
While the others fought amongst themselves for territorial control, Zambada stayed out of the fray and kept an eye on his mentees' movements in prison.
By 1999, El Chapo was even wealthier and more powerful than he'd been when he arrived at Puente Grande. And the recent installment of a new warden only made things better, thanks to the bribes his cousins, the Beltran Leyva brothers, paid him.
El Chapo had started to turn Puente Grande into something like his own estate. The fellow prisoners who came into the fold became his assistants and lieutenants, knowing they and their families would be taken care of in exchange for carrying out his orders.
When his family and friends came to visit, El Chapo had the staff throw decadent parties and gourmet banquets. When he was hungry, he dined on steak and lobster. He even got them to bring him designer clothes and paint his room a cheerful yellow instead of the prison's drab concrete gray.
For the most part, El Chapo never had to threaten anyone to get what he wanted. He knew how to manipulate people. But even those who wanted to refuse him didn't feel like they could. Everyone knew his reputation for killing anyone who stood in his way. There wasn't much point in dying just to take a stand.
Apart from the fact that he was technically in prison, El Chapo had nothing to complain about. He was living like a king in a protected cell in a fiefdom he controlled in all but name. In the 5 years he'd been in prison, he'd become one of the richest and most powerful men in Mexico.
But by the end of 2000, he suddenly decided he was ready to move on. He missed his family and the Sinaloa Mountains, and he had plans for the future of his business. He'd sworn to himself that he'd never be beholden to anyone, and now he would show the government that even they couldn't hold him anymore. It was time to escape from prison.
Coming up, El Chapo disappears from right under everyone's noses.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now back to the story.
In early January 2001, 43-year-old Joaquin El Chapo Guzman decided it was time to get out of prison. For 6 years, he'd been building up his drug empire behind the prison walls, paying off guards, wardens, law enforcement, and the broader Mexican government. But now it was time to get back home.
On the afternoon of January 19th, 2001, he put his escape plan into action. With a sheet hiding the inside of his cell from the security cameras, El Chapo changed out of his prison uniform and into black street clothes.
At 8 p.m., a prison guard on El Chapo's payroll passed by his cell while collecting laundry. He then continued on his route, pushing the large laundry cart all the way through the 5 security checkpoints and out the main gate.
A popular story of El Chapo's escape included him hiding inside the laundry cart. But according to investigative journalist Annabel Hernandez, the security checkpoints at Puente Grande have sensors that would detect anyone trying to sneak out that way. The alarm would have been sounded regardless of how corrupt the guards were. Instead, a more likely story is that El Chapo remained in his cell, biding his time, sipping on rum and cokes. Finally, at 9:30 p.m., two of his lieutenants arrived. It was time to go.
El Chapo and the two men went to the infirmary, where the lieutenants set up a makeshift bed for their boss. After saying their goodbyes, El Chapo settled in for a good night's sleep, while his two lieutenants guarded the door.
By 10:30 p.m., three prison guards arrived at El Chapo's cell to move him to the observation area. But he wasn't there. Frantic, they alerted the warden. But the warden, later accused of being on the narco's payroll, didn't call the federales until 2 a.m.
The Undersecretary of the Interior, other government, and police officials didn't arrive at Puente Grande until 7 a.m. the next morning. They conducted a thorough search of the prison, but there was no sign of their high-value prisoner. El Chapo seemed to have disappeared.
But El Chapo was right under their noses. As the halls flooded with law enforcement, the narco emerged from the infirmary dressed exactly as a prison guard. He strolled right out the front doors of Puente Grande, perhaps even escorted by a group of officers. Someone, possibly even the police, gave him a ride to a helicopter waiting nearby.
While the country marveled at El Chapo's legendary escape and the world criticized the Mexican government's incompetence, the narco himself went on the run. His years managing trafficking around Mexico paid off. He knew influential people in nearly every state who were more than happy to give him a place to stay for the right price.
The growing mythology around his escape helped him too. The average citizen saw it as a demonstration of his power, that he could disappear from right under the government's noses. In a country where a wealthy few oppress the poor majority, the act of defiance made him a folk hero.
But as much as El Chapo enjoyed gaining fans, his focus was on his business. After going into hiding for the first few months after his escape, he met up that spring with Zambada and the Beltran Levar brothers in Toluca, just outside Mexico City.
Family had always been important to El Chapo, and the Beltran Levas were some of his closest allies. But the more senior Zambada was the only elder narco who'd vouched for El Chapo and continued working with him while he'd been in prison. Now that he was free, the two officially decided to become partners, calling their new organization the Sinaloa Cartel. And it was time to scale up.
Despite his history of encroaching on other groups' territories, El Chapo recognized that, right now, he needed to make friends, not enemies. The Gulf Cartel, on Mexico's eastern coast, had grown more powerful in recent years, aligning with a violent paramilitary mercenary group known as Los Zetas. As previous bosses like Felix Gallardo had discovered, sometimes you had to put egos aside and to band together against a common enemy.
In October 2001, El Chapo and Zambada organized a summit in the central city of Cuernavaca. Most of the country's major drug barons were in attendance, except the Gulf Cartel leaders and the Arellano Felix brothers. El Chapo proposed that they form a loose organization known as the Federation. If they worked together, they'd be able to defeat the Arellano Felix brothers and take control of Tijuana and the western border region.
Many of the bosses were skeptical. El Chapo was known for breaking narco codes. How could they be sure that he wouldn't just push them out later?
They came around when he laid out his plan for a more cell-based group structure. Each branch would be mostly autonomous, but they'd also have the insurance of a larger organization. That was something the bosses could all agree to. Within months, the war for Tijuana was on.
In February 2002, Ramon Arellano Felix, the brother who'd personally tried to kill El Chapo in the 1993 airport ambush, came to Sinaloa to strike against the Federation. Having failed to kill El Chapo earlier, Ramon decided to assassinate Zambada instead, in his home city of Mazatlan.
However, Ramon clearly hadn't thought through the fact that Zambada likely owned the entire city. Ramon spent 5 days looking around town, but found no sign of the crime boss anywhere.
On their fifth day cruising the city, Ramon and his men were ambushed by a group of cops who doubled as enforcers for Zambada. Ramon was killed in the ensuing firefight. One Arellano brother down.
A few months later, Benjamin Arellano Felix, the eldest, was suddenly arrested by the police. Word on the street was that El Chapo had used his government connections to get his rival out of the way.
To finish them off, the Federation sent men to terrorize everyone who worked in the brothers' organization, ruthlessly killing junior traffickers throughout Tijuana.
By the summer of 2002, it was clear that the Arellano Felix brothers had lost control of the trafficking hub. El Chapo called the shots now.
El Chapo's war wasn't done, though. With Tijuana conquered, he turned his focus to taking on the Gulf Cartel and the mercenary Zetas, who controlled the northeast border territory. Zambada advised El Chapo not to start another war. The Zetas were too powerful and well-armed.
But El Chapo never balked at a challenge, and he didn't like to be told that he couldn't have something he wanted. Determined to prove he was beholden to no one, he started planning his move.
By 2003, he'd formed his own paramilitary squad, known as Los Negros. He sent them to the northeastern border city of Nuevo Laredo to attack the Gulf Cartel.
Around the same time, perhaps as a result of El Chapo's connections, the head of the Gulf Cartel was arrested, giving the Federation an opening.
But the Zetas weren't going down, not without a fight. They officially merged with the Gulf Cartel and responded to El Chapo's attack with an all-out war.
By the summer of 2003, Nuevo Laredo was transformed into a war zone. The Federation and the Zetas each went after anyone associated with the other side. Any police and military that got in the way were fair game. In fact, a new police chief who'd promised to protect civilians from the cartel war was murdered in broad daylight within 6 hours of being sworn in.
Far from the front lines, El Chapo wasn't worried about the details of the war he'd started or the hundreds of people who were dying. He trusted his associates to do their jobs so he could continue doing what he did best, striking deals with the Colombians and moving drugs into the US through his underground tunnels.
He knew he had to stay at least one step ahead of law enforcement. After all, he was still a fugitive after escaping prison. Luckily, with all the money he had, he figured he'd be able to keep the pressure off his back.
But in 2004, he was going to learn the hard way that the military wouldn't cut him any slack. While much of the government was corrupt, there were a handful of old-school generals who hadn't been seduced by the narcos. And they would stop at nothing to bring El Chapo down.
Coming up, the Mexican military steps up its operations as El Chapo expands his cartel internationally. Now back to the story.
The summer of 2004 marked 3.5 years since 47-year-old El Chapo had escaped from Puente Grande prison. In that time, he had consolidated his power as one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in Mexico. And he did it all while a fugitive of the law.
El Chapo knew the secrets to staying out of police custody. Long ago, he learned that winning hearts and minds was as powerful a tool as any weapon. Through his incarceration and escape, he'd become a folk hero, a man who came from nothing and outwitted the corrupt government. Many ordinary Mexicans felt a sense of affection for a criminal they'd never met.
Once on the outside, he made a point of investing in his home state of Sinaloa, both in the impoverished mountain region he'd come from and in bigger cities like Culiacán. Partly, this was for the benefit of his large extended family, who were as important to him as his empire. But it was also for all the other locals who'd been forgotten by the Mexican government.
El Chapo was known to treat his loyal employees like family and to help out anyone who needed money or resources as long as they were willing to work for him in exchange. Since he moved around the country regularly, he knew that cultivating as much goodwill with the public as possible would help him fly under the radar.
Whenever reports got out that El Chapo had been spotted somewhere, locals would deny it when questioned by law enforcement. Or they'd say it was a mistake. He'd actually been seen somewhere else. No one wanted to be the one to hand Robin Hood over to the Sheriff of Nottingham.
By 2004, the hunt for El Chapo had become a joke. Everyone knew the police were barely pretending to look for him anymore. Frustrated by the widespread failure, a handful of old-school military generals decided that if they wanted El Chapo brought to justice, they would have to find him themselves.
That summer, the military got word that El Chapo was in his hometown of La Tuna and was about to make his way toward the state of Durango. The Air Force could follow the caravan's progress along the winding dirt roads and corner him when he stopped for a break.
Using surveillance planes, the military watched the caravan make its way through the rugged mountains. When the SUVs pulled into a ranch for a rest stop, they made their move.
Suddenly, helicopters appeared on the horizon, catching the narcos unaware. El Chapo's men grabbed their guns, trying to hold off the soldiers.
But El Chapo himself didn't try to fight back. When he realized what was happening, he and his bodyguards took off through the trees and into the rugged wilderness. Unlike the soldiers, they were used to the mountains, and El Chapo knew the locals would be willing to hide him.
By the time the soldiers were able to search the ranch, the drug lord had vanished once again.
A few months later, the military picked up El Chapo's voice on a satellite phone and traced it to a different ranch outside his hometown. Within minutes, more than 200 soldiers descended upon the ranch.
But the narco was already gone. Once again, he'd managed to escape just in the nick of time.
Despite the tightening noose, El Chapo refused to be intimidated. Instead of backing down or lying low, he launched another war, this time targeting one of his supposed allies.
On September 11th, 2004, El Chapo sent a team of assassins to kill Rodolfo Carrillo Fuentes, head of the Juarez cartel, and a member of the Federation. El Chapo, Zambada, and a few of their close associates had agreed that Rodolfo just didn't have what it took to run things like a real narco. they could make the Ciudad Juarez market even more lucrative.
But the assassination didn't guarantee they'd get the chance. The Carrillo Fuentes family's allies struck back at El Chapo. They assassinated one of his brothers, Arturo, and handed intel to the military on another one of his brothers, Miguel Angel.
Miguel Angel was arrested right in front of their mother. By chance, one of El Chapo's sons, Ivan, was also arrested right around the same time.
To a man who valued family so much, these deaths and arrests were tough blows to both his business and his heart.
El Chapo's rivals could tell that the king had been wounded, including the Zetas. Still fighting off the Federation on their own territory, the Zetas saw an opportunity to go on the offensive and move into Ciudad Juarez.
Before long, murders were daily occurrences on the streets of Ciudad Juarez. What started as shootings and stabbings escalated to beheadings and dismemberments.
Often, the remains were scattered around the city and left with messages of warning for the opposing cartel. But sometimes, there weren't even remains. Many bodies were dissolved in acid to dispose of the evidence.
Even innocent civilians disappeared, including men who were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Many were kidnapped and held for ransom, though they often didn't live to see their release. Between 2003 and 2008, approximately 3,000 people, both narcos and civilians, are believed to have been killed in the cartel war.
Like any savvy general, El Chapo realized he couldn't get personally mired in the war in Ciudad Juarez, especially as the military and police entered the fray. He decided to let his foot soldiers continue the battle. In the meantime, he spotted an opportunity to expand his business.
Thus far, the Mexican drug trade had relied either on moving cocaine for the Colombians or growing and trafficking marijuana and heroin themselves. But in the 2000s, synthetic drugs like methamphetamine were starting to catch on. They were cheaper to produce than cocaine, and they could be made right there in Mexico, making them a more lucrative investment.
El Chapo realized that if he built relationships with chemical suppliers in Asia, he could produce meth for next to nothing. They'd be able to traffic it into the US along with their regular shipments, adding no extra costs.
By working with corrupt officials, greedy businessmen, and international crime networks, El Chapo started reaching out to chemical companies in China and Southeast Asia. Once he proved that he was good for the money and could manage the imports without a problem, the opportunities practically came to him.
As he got the levers of the new operation moving, the ambitious narco began to envision how far this new empire could stretch. Unlike organic drugs, he could produce as much synthetic product as he could sell, allowing him to scale up quickly.
Even better, once he owned the US market, he could expand to South America, Europe, and Africa.
Growing up in the Sierra, he'd never imagined anything more than trafficking between Mexico and the US. But suddenly, El Chapo's ambition went global. Let the other narcos fight over Mexican territory. He was operating on a higher level.
El Chapo was right. By 2007, the 50-year-old veteran narco had almost entirely removed himself from the day-to-day of the Mexican drug industry. But in doing so, he allowed holes to form in his operation. Unbeknownst to him, while he was planning his meteoric expansion, some of his closest allies were making overtures to the Zetas. With the help of his biggest rivals, they were plotting to overthrow the king.
Thanks again for listening to Kingpins. Join us next week to find out how El Chapo's ego and ambition ultimately brought him down, but not before he embarrassed the Mexican government on the world stage.
You can find more episodes of Kingpins and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Kingpins for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Kingpins on Spotify, just open the app and type Kingpins in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Kingpins was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Kingpins was written by Kate Thorman, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Kate Leonard and Alistair Merton.